As I indicated at the scripture reading, we begin tonight a series of studies in Paul's missionary journeys with the specific purpose that we might see and learn from the life, the growth, the outreach, and the experience of the early apostolic church. And I thought it would be good for me to give you some indication of why we have come to a decision to do this particular series of studies. Going right away back to the month of May 1987, I can remind some of you at least that beginning in May 1987, on Sunday evenings, we studied the first 8 chapters of Paul's letter to the Romans, studying the great doctrines of salvation, with the emphasis on faith. Then we broke off for some time to study in Hebrews chapter 11, the heroes and the heroines of the faith, finding in them examples in ordinary flesh and blood of all that is meant by the life of faith. After that, we returned to our studies in Paul's letter to the Romans, and in chapters 9, 10, and 11, we were concerned in these very difficult chapters with the great historic sweep of the purposes of God. And immediately after that, from chapter 12 to chapter 16 of Romans, we found ourselves dealing in the most practical of terms with all that we mean by Christian behavior. The whole business of living out the life of faith in a world like this. Having finished our studies in Romans, we then turned to the Old Testament and to that great worship book of the Old Testament, the book of Psalms. And for the past number of Sunday evenings, we've studied Psalms 16 to 30, reading there and learning there of God's dealings with a man of faith. And God dealing with the man of faith, first of all in terms of worship, and then in terms of service. And so, having thought and prayed a great deal, seeking the mind of the Lord, I have no doubt at all that we are doing the right thing when we come now, starting in Acts chapter 13, to consider Paul's missionary journeys and thereby to consider the life of the church. And when we compare the church of apostolic times with the church of our own day and generation, we will learn a great many lessons. Not least finding it being emphasized that the early apostolic church, as we have it recorded here in the scriptures, was not in any sense a perfect church. It wasn't perfect in doctrine, it wasn't perfect in administration, it wasn't perfect in the lives of the members of the church. And yet, I read in Acts chapter 17 verse 6, that church turned the world upside down. That was the criticism leveled by society. Now society, humanistic, secular society nowadays, criticizes the church and criticizes Christians for all sorts of things. But I haven't heard many people criticizing the church of the 1980s because it is turning the world upside down. And therefore, obviously, even though the apostolic church was not perfect, there are things there that we need to learn. And when we read that sixth verse of Acts chapter 17, they dragged some of the brethren before the city authorities, crying, "These men who have turned the world upside down have come here also." we're really reading a story of how angry traditional religion enrolled the yuppies and the yobbos of society to disrupt the church and to oppose the gospel. And yet in a society every bit as secular and degenerate and lost as our own society, when you read the story in the Acts of the Apostles, you find there is being worked out what Jesus said would be worked out. For he was building his church, and the gates of hell could not prevail against it. Secular society and decadent formal religion band together to do everything in their power to stop this gospel movement, and they couldn't. They killed some of the preachers, they persecuted others, they put others in prison, they slandered, they criticized, they did everything they could think of. But Jesus Christ built his church, and the gates of hell could not prevail against it. Now, to my mind, such a story is good for us, and I trust it will prove good for us for quite a few Sunday evenings now. Good for us in terms of instruction. There's a lot to learn. Good for us in terms of challenge. And unless we are terribly dishonest and terribly conceited, we'll admit that we need a good bit of challenge to perk us up in our Christian life and service. But above all else, I think these studies will be good for us in terms of encouragement. And that's something we all need. It will be good for us in terms of encouragement, especially in seeing as we go through successive chapters how the work of God went on in spite of everything. There were so many things to dishearten in the church, because we find Christians backbiting with each other and criticizing each other and disagreeing. There were things to discourage in society. And yet, the church was built. Now, in order to understand as best as possible, we lead into the story by some degree of revision with regard to what we have in the Acts of the Apostles. And I hope you're all willing to learn. Maybe you know it all. Well, in that case, just switch off. But I shouldn't imagine that all that many of us will switch off, because we don't know our Bibles the way that we should know our Bibles. And so in the Acts of the Apostles, in the first 12 chapters, the main character is Peter. And the focus of the life and work of the church was in Jerusalem. And the work of the gospel in the context of society was in the context of a society with religious background and religious tradition. And that is sometimes a help, but that is sometimes a hindrance. Because in these first 12 chapters of the Acts of the Apostles, it is evident that all that we mean by the system of Jewish religion, organized religion, and we've got a lot of organized religion in our own day and generation, and some sections of the church are so busy organizing that they haven't time to do anything else. They haven't time to preach the gospel, and they haven't time to pray. They're just organizing. Seems rather futile, but that's by the way. And in these first 12 chapters of Acts, organized religion had lost its vision. And it had lost the respect of the people. It was a whole system of organized religion which was obsessed with church law. It was a system of organized religion that was not much concerned with what people believed or what people didn't believe, even among the ministers. A bit like our own day and generation. Because in the Jewish church of that day, the Pharisees would never agree with the Sadducees because the Sadducees didn't agree with the resurrection. That poor bishop in England thinks he's saying some marvelously new things when he's denying the resurrection. It's old hat. The Sadducees, they didn't believe in resurrection at all, let alone believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But you see, what people believed and what people didn't believe didn't seem to matter. But if anybody stepped out of line with regard to church law, oh, there was an uproar. Didn't we read this morning in the Gospels that Jesus was out walking with his disciples, and it was the Sabbath, and some of the disciples pulled some ears of corn and rubbed it in their hands to eat? Oh, that was considered, that was the equivalent of reaping on the Sabbath. They had stepped out of line and there was an uproar. And as a result of that kind of thing, the leaders of the Jewish religion began to plan how best to dispose of Jesus. Right through the stories of the Gospels, we find it in the life of Jesus that the lawyers of the church weren't interested in what Jesus was saying. The lawyers of the church weren't interested in who Jesus was. They weren't particularly interested in his death or in his resurrection. But as far as they were concerned, the religious laws, the laws of organized religion, were absolutely paramount. And it was the devotees of religious law who sent the Son of God to his death. And right through Acts chapters 1 to 12, it was these religious people who opposed and persecuted the gospel, and those who preached it, and those who were disposed to believe it. And they did this in spite of that wonderful counsel of caution given by the Pharisee Gamaliel, when he said, "Now look here, be careful. If this work is of God, you can do nothing against it. If it's not of God, it'll come to nothing. Be very, very careful lest you be found fighting against God." I find that a frightening thought, to be fighting against God. And so we come to the second half of the Acts of the Apostles, beginning in chapter 13. And the main character is Paul. Formerly Saul of Tarsus, now Paul, the great missionary apostle. We read of him in our scripture reading in Acts chapter 9. It's a very vivid verse. Saul still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord. Some of the young ministers still tell me at times they go to their new charges and they're preaching the gospel and they say, "Oh," they say, "Mr. of the other Sunday when I was preaching, there was this man or this woman. Oh, I could see from their faces they were just hating every minute of it." Well, that's nothing new. Saul of Tarsus was like that, breathing threats and murder against Christ, against the gospel, and against the disciples. But then you see, God laid hold on Saul of Tarsus, confronted him with Jesus Christ, overcame his reluctance, demolished his unbelief, and made him a glorious disciple. I don't know if some of you are praying for people and maybe prayed for them a long time, and you're beginning to despair and think, you think, oh, could folk like that ever be converted? The answer is yes. So don't stop praying. So we begin in Acts chapter 13 with the main character, Paul, and the focus of the work moves away from Jerusalem. Because up to that point, the work of the gospel had been largely limited to Jerusalem and the area immediately around Judea. It was very much a Jewish thing. But now the gospel began to spread out into the Gentile world, the secular world, the world that had no real biblical or religious background. And the odds seemed very much against the gospel. But the story is exciting, and the story is costly, and the story is stormy. And one of the things we have to see, and I'm telling you this right at the beginning of the series so that you'll keep it in mind as we go on, one of the things we've got to see is what we indicated in our opening prayer and what we indicated in that hymn before the sermon. The thing we have to see is God's providence, God's sovereign, overruling providence. I remember it must be about 25 years ago, sitting in the old parish church in Auburn during holiday time. And in the opening prayer of the service, the minister referred to the silent working of everlasting providence. Now, 25 years is a good long time to remember a bit of a prayer, isn't it? But my, it grasped my mind and my heart. The silent working of everlasting providence. I think it's a phrase from the Anglican prayer book. And we have to learn to see God's providence. God's providence in preparing situations. Time and time again, when Paul and his companions arrived at a certain place, and as circumstances began to work out, they were compelled to say, God is here. Now I can imagine Paul saying to somebody who said that, yes, and God was here before we arrived. That's what I mean by God's providence. He doesn't wait till we and his work reach a certain situation, and then God says, well, let's have a discussion to see what we'll do now. Not a bit of it. He goes ahead. An older generation and an older school of theologians used to speak of God's prevenient grace. The grace of God that always goes before. Preparing the way. Preparing situations. And preparing the people for the situation. Now I don't know, there may be some of you here within a few weeks will be in a completely different situation from what you are now. Don't worry. God knows about it. God is there before you. He prepares the situation. He prepares. Oh, you see, I don't know that God's preparing. Don't doubt that. Oh, you say, but Mr. Liv, I'm not sure that my spiritual life and my prayer life are all that they should be. Well, that may be so. Well, you better put that right. But I'm quite sure that God is preparing. He always does. Preparing us, preparing the journey, and preparing the place. So that he may work out his purposes of grace. And that is why we couldn't start tonight simply at Acts chapter 13 at verse 1 with the call and the sending out of Paul and Barnabas. Because you see, if we go back to Acts chapter 8 at verse 2, we read there, or verse 1 rather, a great persecution arose against the church in Jerusalem, and the Christians were all scattered throughout the region of Judea and Samaria except the apostles. Now, that was a situation where the Lord was adding to the church daily those who were being saved. My, what a throbbing spell in the life of the church it was. How glad the disciples were. Things were going well. The church was being built. Their hearts were glad. And then out of the blue, a great surge of persecution. And the Christians were scattered. And we have to see from that, of course, weren't volunteers. They were refugees. There was no question as to whether or not they felt called to go. There was no question as to whether or not they wanted to go. Persecution made them go. And at the time when everything was going well, so well, and the Lord was adding to the church and the work being blessed, there was this outburst of persecution. And when you read about it, first of all, you think, what a tragedy. Just when the work was going so well, it wasn't a tragedy. There was spiritual fire in the church in Jerusalem. And God scattered the fire and started numberless fires, spiritual fires, all over the place. When I was writing that down in my bit of paper for my sermon notes, I found myself thinking, I don't know how many years back. I meant to ask Tom Ferguson how many years he had been church officer, because this is before Tom Ferguson was church officer, and Dougal Downey was the church officer. And I remember one Sunday night, he's an interesting man. I don't think he'd ever come across a church quite like this one. I'm not sure exactly how he meant that. But I remember on one occasion he said to me after a Sunday evening service, Mr. Philip, I think there's too many real Christians here. Other places could do with some of them. Maybe he had a point. Maybe the church of Jerusalem was getting too comfortable. You know, success makes you very comfortable. When the situation arises, for example, that on one given Sunday, when there's maybe been a huge congregation, and you're saying to your office bearers as you go away, if it's like this next Sunday, we better be ready to take chairs up from the church hall. Success can make you very comfortable. Success can make you very self-confident. But God moves in a mysterious way, His wonders to perform. And there came the great blast of persecution. And the Christians were scattered. And the missionary work began. God, you see, has His methods. And the work began to spread, and we are told in Acts chapter 8 that one of the Christians went to Samaria. Now the Jews would have no dealings with the Samaritans. They were a bad lot. They were a decadent lot. But when this Christian ended up there preaching, there was a revival. Oh, you say, that's astonishing. Not a bit. There was somebody else who had visited Samaria. In John's Gospel, chapter 4, Jesus. And a lot of people believed. And their witness must have continued. And then, when eventually persecution shot a preacher from Jerusalem into Samaria, and he began to preach, he was overwhelmed. People were being converted right, left, and center. You see, God does go before, preparing the way. And also in Acts chapter 8, we are told about a very high-ranking civil servant, a chancellor of the exchequer, I think, who was an Ethiopian, and he was heading away back to Egypt and Ethiopia. Well, he was prepared. But then, you see, he was going away back from Jerusalem, reading his Bible, but he hadn't yet come to faith in Jesus Christ. And the Spirit of God said to Philip, was it not? Go! And he went. And there, sitting in the chariot, can you picture it? The posh, magnificently dressed Chancellor of the Exchequer. And the evangelist, well, he had run a long way to catch up with the chariot. He'd been covered in dust. Can you imagine the two of them sitting in the jolting chariot, reading the Bible, Isaiah chapter 53, and the man being led to Jesus? Well, it was all prepared, you see. It was all prepared. And then we read in Acts chapter 11 at verse 9. If I can get the verse 19. Now those who were scattered because of the persecution that arose over the martyrdom of Stephen traveled as far as Phoenicia, going up the coast, eventually coming to Antioch on the south coast of Asia Minor, and some of them went over that little bit of sea to the island of Cyprus, speaking the word or preaching the word to none except the Jews. Preaching to those who had a religious and an Old Testament background. And then Gentiles, outsiders, began to believe. I don't know what that does to you, but it makes my heart say, Lord, do it in Glasgow. I look forward to being with you Sunday by Sunday. But how I long to see those outside brought to Christ. Well, the outsiders, mind you, there was persecution. Oh dear. Is that going to be the way to bring salvation to Glasgow? Is it going to be persecution? I don't know. Please God, if that is the way, that we will be given grace to stand. The outsiders began to believe, and so much so we read in that passage that the church headquarters in Jerusalem decided they had to investigate to see whether or not this was a real or a valid spiritual work. So they sent Barnabas. And when Barnabas came, verse 23, and saw the grace... No, it didn't say when Barnabas came and saw people, he saw the grace of God. As soon as Barnabas came, this is real. This is real spiritual work. You can see it in the people. And when Barnabas came and saw the grace of God, he was glad, and he exhorted them to remain faithful to the Lord with steadfast purpose, and he was a good man full of the Holy Spirit, and a large company was added to the Lord. And Barnabas, what a humble man he must have been. What a chance there was here for him personally to make a name for himself. It was all happening and he was there in the spot. But what a humble man Barnabas was. He said, this is a situation that needs a theological preacher like Paul. So he said to the Christians, hold on a while, I'm going to Tarsus. I'll bring you the man. I know it's a wrong way to put it, but I'll bring you a man, and he'll expound to you the doctrines of Paul's letter to the Romans. And so Barnabas went to look for Saul, and when he had found him, he brought him to Antioch. He must have been very persuasive. He persuaded Paul that this was a work that really needed him. And for a whole year they met with the church and taught a large company of people. And in Antioch the disciples were for the first time called Christians. I've been reading some of the commentaries and dictionaries and been refreshing my mind and memory with the fact that it was quite astonishing that there should be such a work in a place like Antioch. Because at that time Antioch was the third city of the world after Rome and Alexandria. And what a city! It was wealthy, it was magnificent, it was arrogant, it was indulgent. It was also rotten. And some people, so the commentators tell me, some people referred to the life of the society of the city that we call Antioch. They describe the life of Antioch as a flow of sewage. Not a very nice place to be called to be the minister. But Paul and Barnabas were there for a whole year teaching the people. And the believers grew in grace and you couldn't mistake them. But oh, the society of Antioch didn't like people like that. And they called them Christians. You Christians. Then at the end of chapter 11, we have the prophecy about the famine and how they decided to send relief to the Christians in Judea and Jerusalem. And it was the two ministers who were sent away with a collection. Was that a wrong decision? Couldn't someone else have done it? But I don't know. The church suggested it and Paul and Barnabas agreed. And they went. Did they feel that their work was completed in Antioch? I don't think they did, because they went back again. Did they feel that having been taught well in the scriptures right from the start of their conversion, these Christians were able to stand? That seems to be the case. And as far as we can understand, there was some considerable delay in carrying out the trip to Jerusalem. And then we come to the end of chapter 12, that Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem when they had fulfilled their mission, bringing with them John, whose other name was Mark. They were back in Antioch, back in the congregation where they had taught for a year. Now, that's the first word of chapter 13. We haven't really time to go much into it tonight, but now, God had the whole situation prepared. That brings us back to the beginning of the sermon. The sovereign providence of God, His great work of preparation. And when we come to these opening verses of Acts chapter 13, we are aware of the fact that a new stage and a new development of the work of the gospel was imminent, whether the Christians were aware of it or not. God had His plans. He always has. And I'm mighty glad. There's nothing uncertain about the future. Honest. God has His plans. Oh, you say, yes, preacher, you mentioned in a prayer about our times being in God's hand. Yes. So if He's got His plans, and it's all prepared, and we are in God's hand, where's the uncertainty? There isn't any. Does not Scripture say in Paul's letter to the Philippians chapter 1 that he who began the good work in you will bring it to completeness. And he will. God had his plans. God had prepared two men. God had the faraway situation prepared. And God, oh now this is important, especially in this day and generation when there is amongst evangelicals such a despising of the doctrine of the church and the life of the church and commitment to the church. God had plans, God had prepared two men, God had prepared situations, and God had prepared a church that would be the prayer backing of the new work that was about to begin through the instrumentality of Paul and Barnabas. And God spoke. Now, don't ask me how God spoke. I don't know. But God spoke. Doesn't say that God spoke to Barnabas on his own and said, Barnabas, I want you to be a missionary. Doesn't say that God spoke to Paul on his own and said, Paul, I want you to be a missionary. God spoke to the church. In a sense, put it into contemporary terms, God didn't speak to the missionary society or the missionary agency. God spoke to the church. I wonder how many Christians there are here in this congregation tonight who are not in any sense committed in any real spiritual way to the life of a congregation. I wonder how many Christians there are here tonight who, though they may be members of a congregation, cannot in any sense be counted on to be at the prayer meeting of their own congregation with any degree of regularity. It's not surprising that the missionary work of the church is contracting. It is not surprising that the church is not turning the world upside down. God spoke to the church. And the church, not just Paul and Barnabas, the church heard what God said. Because the church was listening. And the church was willing to hear what God was saying to them. And the whole essence of the worship of that church in Antioch was meeting with God. And when they came together for worship, they came expecting to meet God. And expecting God to speak to them and to say things to them and to direct them and to control them and to enable them. Now, my friends, I must draw to a close. You can come to church, a real biblical church, and you can enjoy it and you can benefit from it, and yet never in any real sense meet with God. Because you are not expecting to. Did you expect to meet with God when you came here tonight? Did you expect God to be saying things to you that would have a specific application to and effect on your Christian life and service in coming days? That's how we ought to come to church. And when we say at the beginning of a service, let us worship God, that's not just a religious way of saying, let's sing the first psalm or hymn. When we say, let us worship God, we are saying, let us come to God. Let us open our minds and our hearts to God. And let us look to God. And the place to find guidance on a variety of levels, and especially with regard to Christian service, The place to find guidance is not on our own, nor from outside sources, but in your place in the fellowship to which you belong. And I think it's a tremendous thrill to become aware that we are involved with God. It thrills my heart and it awes my heart. Folk like us, involved with God. It thrills my heart even more when I think that we are under the direction of God. And God said, set apart for me Barnabas and Saul for the work to which I have called them. Chosen and called, not just for salvation, but for service. And Paul never forgot this. Became more and more a thrill and an inspiration and an encouragement throughout his whole life. This is evident. I close the sermon with this. At the beginning of Paul's letter to the Romans, he speaks about himself as being called, set apart, and sent by God. In Galatians chapter 1 at verse 15, he says, oh, I see it now. I see it now. God who set me apart before I was ever born. And he called me by his grace. Oh, said Paul, I see it now. Oh, I see it now. My times are in his hand. And when God said, set apart Paul and Barnabas, these two dear men, without a moment's hesitation, said, Lord, here am I. Send me. What a God, and what a privilege to serve him. Now let's sing our communion hymn.